Chapter 27. It was morning in Pocket, Madagascar. Normally, this was Spence's favorite time of the eco-module's artificial day, but without Tully, the magic was gone. Now the sunshine was only simulated daylight on a dimmer switch. The blue sky, the clouds, the tiny daytime half-moon were all just elements in a simple holographic projection any six-year-old could produce. One of the ring-tailed lemurs approached her in the tall grass, hesitating every half meter or so until it finally reached her. It waited, briefly, then climbed into her lap and hugged her. The affection completely undid her. She broke down in tears as she cuddled the little primate, feeling how fast its heart was beating. Tully had engineered the lemurs just for her because he knew she liked them. "Tully, you stupid asshole. You stupid, stupid asshole." The cool morning air touched the back of her neck, sending a chill down her spine and along her arms. Her grandmother had said it meant a goose walked over your grave. Back then, the expression had sent Spence into a fit of giggles. It wasn't funny anymore. On Rodina Station, Lukhai was having the same sensation. Her foster sister, Zara, had referred to it as the devil tapping on your shoulder. Zara had been a devout believer in all things occult, which Lukhai took as absolute proof that capitalist society didn't know the difference between culture and a brain disorder. Well, Ashok had said the mind came up with some pretty crazy shit at the wildest times. She gazed at his body on the deck beside her, wishing she could have told him he was right. A shower of acid blood had burned through his armor in only seconds. It would have landed on her, except he had stepped in front of her. It was the first time she had screamed in her adult life, and it hadn't drowned out the hissing of the acid doing its work. She hoped Ashok hadn't lived long enough to hear her. Now, it was on her to make sure he hadn't died for nothing. But she wasn't sure that was possible. Life had no meaning to these creatures except as something to be wiped out. For all she knew, it was why they were here. Unlike ops, MedLab didn't seem to be short-staffed, Hicks noted absently as he walked through the outpatient ward on his way to Ripley's room in critical care. Only one person made a move to approach him, a young, anxious-looking guy in nursing scrubs. One of the other nurses caught his arm and pulled him back. Hicks didn't hear what she said to him, probably explaining that you didn't tell a Marine in battle armor to come back during regular visiting hours. He found Ripley, alone in her room. According to the tablet at the foot of her bed, her condition was something deeper than delta sleep, but not a coma or a persistent vegetative state. Leave it to Ripley to find her own unique level of unconsciousness. The notes said there was no telling when or if she would find her way back from wherever she was, but Hicks knew the longer someone remained unconscious, the less likely they were to come out of it. Ripley didn't stir as he pushed the machines aside and plucked the electrodes from her forehead and out of her hair. He removed the IV carefully, making sure there was no blood leaking from the back of her hand. Her medical record would be on her locator chip, and the information would be accessible no matter where she ended up. There was no gurney in the room, but the bed had wheels. Hicks released the brakes and started to push it out into the hall, then caught sight of Newt's map. "Not to scale, but close enough for government work," he muttered as he peeled it off the wall. "Correction. Too good for government work," he added as he folded it carefully and tucked it under the neckline of Ripley's hospital gown. All space stations placed hospitals close to lifeboat bays, so Hicks didn't have far to go with Ripley. He half expected someone to call security on him, maybe even send a negotiator to talk him into releasing his hostage. But the most anyone did was stare and move out of his way. From her desktop console, the receptionist opened the door to the departure hall without raising an eyebrow, as if Marines hurried past her with unconscious people in hospital beds all the time. At the very end of the hallway, Hicks saw the small rectangular screen on the entry hatch light up. The receptionist had prepped it for him remotely, and he ran for it. Just below the screen was a 6-centimeter vertical slot. He fished his dog tags out of his shirt and inserted one without removing it from the chain around his neck. A sine wave appeared on the display while the hatch thought things over. Seconds later, his dog tag slid out, and he heard a rapid series of clicks as the locks disengaged. The doors swung open, and Hicks crossed a short walkway to the lifeboat airlock, which was already open for boarding. The vessel was a six-pack, the smallest model available in this bay. Its sleep capsules were laid out in an asterisk, with food supplies in transparent cabinets, so passengers would see them on waking. At the far end was the open-plan cockpit and the controls for navigation, comms, and life support. The economical space would be a snug fit for half a dozen passengers, even if only half of them were awake at a time, but it would probably feel pretty empty to Ripley. Still, she'd be safe.
"Sorry, Ripley, I'm not taking liberties," he said softly, picking her up in his arms. "But you can't make this trip in a hospital bed."
Her head lulled against his shoulder like a sleepy child's, and Hicks froze, afraid he'd woken her. But there was no change in her breathing or her face, no sign of returning awareness. Relieved, Hicks carried her into the lifeboat and placed her gently in the capsule facing the airlock. Before closing the lid, he waited another half minute or so in case she woke up, and then lingered a few minutes longer, telling himself he was making sure there were no malfunctions while the capsule scanned her. Eventually, he ran out of excuses. Ripley had paid her dues. Twice. The first time, it had cost her the life she should have lived, with her daughter and her grandchildren. The second time, it had stolen her second chance to be a mother and raise Newt in a world where you woke up from nightmares, not to them. He was damned if he'd let her face something worse than the chest burster. And as much as he wanted to talk himself into going with her, he knew he'd never be able to justify it.
"Corporal Hicks," Bishop said politely in his ear. "Yeah, hang on."
Someone had gotten station-wide comms working again, Hicks thought, probably Bishop. He sealed the lifeboat and the entry hatch, then initiated the launch sequence. The countdown was a full minute, and Hicks watched every second displayed on the small screen. The deck under his feet vibrated as the lifeboat disengaged and the screen flickered, changing from confirmation of the launch to a real-time video feed of the lifeboat slowly moving back from the berth. As soon as it was clear, it executed an almost dignified 180 and began to accelerate away from anchor point into the starry black.
"Okay, go ahead."
"I take it Ripley's hospital scans were clear?" Bishop asked.
"You take it correctly," Hicks said. "She was never directly exposed to the new, improved model of those bastards, and now she never will be. She deserves to sit this one out."
Pause.
"I owe her that much,"